Good morning and welcome to the Tuesday edition of The Morning Show with your hosts, Phil Huff and Julie Calamine.
Good morning, Phil.
How are you doing, Julie?
Well, really well. How are you doing?
Well, I'm wonderful. Coming across the Long Bridge, seeing the skies clear after a soggy weekend and fresh snow on the ground.
I know it. Snow up on the mountains.
Yeah, we got around and played in the snow a little bit yesterday at about 4,500 feet.
Way to go, Phil. I was down in the valleys with the opener of elk season. And before that, I was finishing up my first aid class through Friends of Scotchman Peak. Thank you, Friends of Scotchman Peak, for that wilderness class.
So now everybody will be wanting to be your hiking partner since you know how to take care of them.
That's right, although I've got a big list for improving my first aid kit. It was embarrassing. Yeah, so our guest this morning, and I think everyone will be excited to hear about this project, is Bob Betts. I believe you're a retired archaeologist, Bob, but your most recent and very interesting project that everyone in Sandpoint will be interested in hearing more about was the Sandpoint Bypass Project. Good morning, Bob.
Good morning. Glad to be here.
So happy to have you here. We'll be back to Bob in a minute, but before that, we're going to talk a little bit about the weather.
Sure. And so we're coming off this wet spell. And outside, it's beautiful. And yes. The National Weather Service says today is going to become increasingly sunny with a high around 48. So it's getting cooler. Certainly there's that fall nip in the air. Did you have a frost last night, Julie?
Not last night, which is interesting because you've probably all heard this. I had frost on June 15th at my house in Sagal, so I was sure I would have it last night.
Yeah, we dodged it, but it could be coming. Tonight is mostly clear, and then frost in the weather forecast, a low of 27.
Yes. Now, moving on, I'd just like to remind everyone that we're listening to 88.5 KRFY, listener-supported radio. We have live streaming for you folks if you're not able to catch us, and we also have a podcast that you can listen to later on. But let's move on into the interview. Bob, let's get started, and you can tell us a little bit about your background. Tell us where everything began for you in archaeology.
Well, I do have a story about that. It all started in Alaska. I went to Alaska in 1966. I was hired by the Bureau of Land Management as a smoke jumper out of Fairbanks. My first time in Alaska, I had no idea how big the state was. And we would fly out of Fairbanks following thunderstorms, looking for fires. We would fly for hours through mountains and rivers and tundra and endless spruce forest. I had the feeling, looking out the window of the airplane, that we were flying over country nobody had been to before. Nobody had walked there before. And we would jump the fires. And on my second or third parachute jump out of the plane, as I was getting out of my jump gear, I looked down at the ground and I saw a beautiful spear point, an obsidian spear point on the ground. I had landed on an archaeological site. I knew nothing about archaeology at the time. I knew nothing about the prehistory of Alaska. But I suddenly realized that I wasn't the first person to walk on that piece of Alaska before. It got me thinking about archaeology and prehistory, where those people had come from, who they were, how they got there. But it was later that winter. I was going to school in California and studying forestry. Had a friend in Spanish class who I went to Mexico with that winter in Mexico City. And he took me out to see the pyramids just outside Mexico City, the city of the gods, Teotihuacan. It's a massive site, a huge pyramid of the moon. We climbed, and pyramid of the sun. We climbed the pyramid of the sun, the largest one. And I stood on top of that pyramid and I looked out over Teotihuacan and I thought, I want to be an archaeologist. I went back to California, dropped out of college there, quit my forestry studies, went to Mexico to study archaeology. And so my early experience was in Central America and Mexico as an archaeologist, and that's where I got my undergraduate degree.
Very interesting. And did you go on with a little more education in the U.S.?
Well, I went to graduate school in Alaska.
Ah.
So I followed that time in Central America, where I specialized in lowland Maya civilizations. And then I went back to Alaska and studied Arctic and subarctic archaeology.
So for a budding archaeologist, which would you recommend, digging in the frozen ground in Alaska or doing some above-the-ground stuff in Mexico?
I didn't much like the snakes in the jungle in Central America. I love the archaeology. And I probably would have stayed in Mexico and Guatemala and Belize, except that I was working my way through school, and I could make the money in Alaska. And I also thought that graduate school, getting a degree from an American university in the USA, would further my career better than a school in Mexico. I was going to the University of Americas in Mexico, which was accredited in the United States, but still, I picked the University of Alaska.
So how much of an archaeologist's training, how much of your training is about techniques of discovery, and how much is cultural interpretation? How much background do you need in the different cultural experiences that you find yourself in?
Archaeology programs involve, almost all of them, in fact, involve field schools. And so it's actually in the field schools that you get the hands-on experience of digging and the techniques and the laboratory experience and analysis of artifacts. But the programs are all within the broader discipline of anthropology. So in that context, you were taking classes in cultural anthropology and linguistics and physical anthropology and archaeology. So you can specialize within that. But it's archaeology is one subdiscipline of a larger branch of archaeology, of anthropology.
But everyone gets a little bit of that Indiana Jones experience if they go through that kind of a program.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, fun. Why, Bob, why do we care about our archaeology today? What's, you know, I mean, there's some obvious reasons, but what makes people work on it these days?
Well, archaeologists like to say that the past is prologue, that to understand where we're going, we need to know where we've been. And here in Idaho, our written history only goes back to 1809, when David Thompson arrived. Before that, and where there's thousands of years of history before that, the only thing that we have is archaeology to tell us who was here and what kind of activities occurred here up until the first white contact. So archaeology is only part of the picture. It's only the material culture. And you lose a lot. You lose a lot of the language, the religious beliefs. So much of it is not preserved in the ground. It's the physical, material culture that you're recovering.
Well, tell us a little bit. I know you've been all over the North and South America, but in later years you came further north. You've told us that. And I know you focused most recently on Sandpoint, but before that you were in northern Idaho. Tell us a little bit about projects that have related to this part of the country. Let's talk about that pre-written history.
Well, when I came here, 1995, after about almost 25 years in Alaska with the University of Alaska and my own contracting in Alaska. We moved to Sandpoint in 1995. My wife and I had bought property here in the 1970s, but we weren't able to live here on a permanent basis until 1995. And so I became involved. I was still had my contracting business, so I was still doing projects in Alaska, but over time I became more focused on North Idaho. I worked for a company at the time called Northwest Archaeological Associates initially, as I was building up my contract business here in Idaho. Much of the work that was being done in Idaho was funded by the Corps of Engineers, and that focused on the Pend'Oreille River, the Clark Fork, Lake Pend'Oreille. After Albany Falls Dam was built in the 1950s, a great deal of erosion resulted from that, and archaeological sites began showing up everywhere. Back in the 1950s, the Smithsonian Institute conducted a couple of surveys prior to the construction of the dam, in which they didn't find very much, and they basically wrote off Lake Pend'Oreille and the Pend'Oreille River as having not much prehistory. But suddenly, the dam was built, and the higher water levels started the erosion, and sites started showing up everywhere, including sites that had thousands of years old.
Very exciting. And that must have gotten lots of archaeologists.
Well, it took some effort to get the Corps of Engineers to to start funding some of the surveys that were conducted in the mostly started in the 1970s, 1980s, all along the impoundment for behind the Albany Falls Dam. So now we know of literally hundreds of sites along the Ponderay River and around the lake, mostly the north end of the lake. And quite a bit of testing of those sites has been done, but very few actual excavations in this area. It's a handful of excavations.
And people run into artifacts, don't they, just wandering the shore of the lake? I've heard of this, arrowheads and other interesting objects.
Back when the dam was first built, I have interviewed a number of residents that have a long history in Sandpoint, and you could go out in an afternoon and collect a pocketful of arrowheads. And I've talked to people who did that, and there are a number of large private collections. It was not illegal to collect arrowheads from the surface, and so there were many collections of arrowheads from that period.
So the construction of the dam in the 50s wasn't what triggered the archaeological discovery, but the erosion and the subsequent studies done in the 70s. Who did those studies? Were those conducted by the Army Corps of Engineers or some other entity? Who oversaw them?
The Corps, by far, has funded most of the studies and survey. Mm-hmm. The Forest Service has also conducted surveys with timber sales. Their surveys are in higher elevation areas where the trees mm-hmm. are. And are not as have not resulted in as many discoveries. We know very little about the higher elevations, but we know a lot about the river margins.
So, as the Corps was directing the work being done, were they doing it in conjunction with the local area tribes?
There are memorandums of agreement with the tribes, the Kalispell Tribe, the Kootenai, the Coeur d'Alenes, and even with the Byway Project, the tribes were very much involved and kept informed of what was going on. And signed a memorandum of agreement to involve the tribes.
So without giving away the end of the book here, as it were, how much of the tribal involvement was a matter of their looking at things and helping interpret it, and how much was a process of discovery of their own history during this?
I actually was a tribal archaeologist. I worked for the Kalispell Tribe for 3 years from about 1999 through 2001. So I've had a foot in both worlds as a tribal archaeologist and as working outside the tribe. And it's a different perspective from the tribe. They, of course, are less interested in the historical aspects in thinking of the Byway Project. They were less interested in the history of Sandpoint than they were in the evidence for prehistoric use of the area. Mm-hmm. We did a lot of oral history work with tribal elders. Most of our knowledge of this area comes from work done in the 1930s with tribal elders by Alan Smith from the Washington State University. He did 3 years of research with the tribe in the lower Ponderay down around Usk. And a lot of the sites we know about come from those studies, those oral history studies, and then a lot of the what we know about the land use prior to the arrival of the whites, village sites and seasonal campsites, a lot of that comes from those oral history studies. So the tribes are very much involved with this.
Are these sites places that one can visit at this time? Are they restricted? How does that work today?
Site locations are generally very restricted. Some sites are known. There are rock art sites around the lake, at least one of which is quite well known now by Denton Slough. There are a number of other sites that very few people know about, but there's a very large concentration of rock art, petroglyphs, mostly petroglyphs rather than pictograph sites around the lake. Most of the archaeological reports have fairly restricted distribution. They're distributed to libraries and museums and universities. They're generally not publicly available. When those reports do have site locations, maps showing site locations, they're either as appendices that may not be included with the publicly distributed reports, or they may show, have large enough dots on those maps so that you can't really, you're not specific to a location that.
You basically don't want people visiting those sites all the time, it sounds like.
Well, we do have a problem with collection, although it's not illegal, as long as you don't disturb the ground. The first legislation that protected sites was the Antiquities Act in 1906. That was fairly broad, didn't prohibit collecting from the surface, and the penalties were fairly minimum. But that was the first step. And then later in 1979, we have the Archaeological Resources Protection Act, which has more teeth in it, and that is generally what is the basis for preventing vandalism or collection. But it still doesn't prohibit surface collecting.
Is that true across all jurisdictions? Or the national parks, I thought you couldn't collect anything even from the surface.
Right. If you're in a national park, a different set of rules there. But broadly speaking, on public land, these laws are public laws. They're the Antiquities Act and the Archaeological Resources Protection Act are for public lands.
Right.
Park Service has, you're not supposed to collect anything at all from the parks.
And of course, if you are on private lands, you probably shouldn't be, or have an arrangement with the owner.
Private landowners in Idaho can do pretty much whatever they want, as long as human burials are not involved. But archaeological sites on private land can landowners can pretty much do what they want. If they're going to build a residence or something and they're impacting a site, there's no laws that will prevent them from doing that.
So let's come back to the lake. I'd love to hear more about the story of what was found in the 70s from the various sites that were discovered.
Well, the first thing when we're doing the survey, usually the first thing we see are fragments of fire-broken rock. And these are the most frequent artifacts at a site, or they're the most obvious, because the Salish people, the Kalispel, one of their main subsistence activities was digging the camas bulb. And this is what they didn't have salmon here, so they relied on camas because they could store it over the winter. They could dry it and store it, so that was their substitute for salmon. They baked the camas in underground ovens, and so they would dig these ovens, and they would line them with rocks. They would heat rocks. They would put the camas in different layers, and often they would put moss in there with the camas, and then they would add rocks. And then they would build a fire on top of it. And so that would crack the rocks. And then when they dug up the camas ovens, those rocks would get scattered around. And so what we find all up and down the lake, around the shore of Lake Pend'Oreille and along the river, are concentrations of fire-cracked rock or fire-broken rock. And that keys us in to start looking for other artifacts in that vicinity. And so then we'll find chopping tools, which are flaked stones, which were used to butcher animals with, or to break up bones to get marrow out of bones. We'll find sometimes fishing weights from fishing activity. We'll find what we like to find the most, of course, is our projectile points, because it's the typology of the projectile points that will key us into the age of the site. And based on the morphology of those points, and I use that a lot on the byway to be able to try to date some of the prehistoric activity in the byway project.
You're talking about spear points?
These are, well, the older points, if you're going back beyond 5,000 years, are larger and likely to be spear points. Sometimes it's hard to tell the difference between a point and a knife. As you come forward in time into 3, 4, 3,000, 4,000 years ago, you find dart points. These are from atlatls. These are spear thrower points. They're larger points, and there's a sequence, a typology of those, based largely on the notching and the style of the base, that we can get general dates from those if we don't have radiocarbon dates to work with. As you come into more recent times, you get smaller points. You get arrow points. Now, the bow and arrow didn't occur or wasn't utilized around in this area till maybe 1,700 years ago, 2,000 years ago. And so if you're finding those small arrow points, you're looking at activity within the last couple thousand years.
Did the change in weaponry have to do with like new technology that they were developing, or did it have to do with the animals they were seeking out? Do you know?
Largely with, the earliest Paleo-Indian hunters were hunting larger game. They were using bigger points, spear points, much larger points. That when they were the first hunters that came into this area, as much as 9 or 10 or even 11,000 years ago, were big game hunters. They weren't focused on the river systems. They were hunting larger game. They were using larger points. As time passed, the focus became on the larger game. Essentially, was the mammoths, the horse, the bison, the other large animals were exterminated. They focused on larger game, a more diverse resource base. Smaller animals, the points are smaller. They're using the atlatl, the spear thrower. And so then, as with the development of the bow and arrow, they're starting to focus more on the river, more on fishing, and we find the sites along in the lower terraces along the river. We know of this change because the early sites occur on the higher terraces up of the river and on the higher terrain, and then as the rivers, after the deglaciation, as rivers stabilized, and fish populations increased, then the focus is more on the river systems. And so you find more evidence of fishing, and you find evidence of the use of bow and arrow.
So it sounds like you're establishing a timeline for occupancy of the area that goes back about 10,000 years?
Well, there's a lot of still trying to figure all that out. But we know that 14,000 years ago, this area was covered with 2,000 feet of ice. The height of the last glaciation occurred around 18 to 22,000 years ago, and then around 14,000 years ago, the climate started to warm up, and we start getting the Lake Missoula floods, the Ice Age floods. And that would even occurred as recently as maybe 12,000 years ago. So until sometime after 12,000 years ago, between the ice and the Lake Missoula floods, this was not an area that would be very conducive to habitation.
Not hospitable.
Not hospitable at all.
Sounds bad. All that ice. Yuck.
Yeah, 2,000 feet of ice over Sandpoint, and you can tell from the glacial erratics that are up there around 4,000 feet on the mountainsides up on Scotchman Peak. And but it would have taken a while if deglaciation was pretty much over by 11,000 or 11,500 years ago. It still would have taken a period of time. Hundreds of years, probably, for the landscape to stabilize, for plants to move in, for the animals to come in once the plants are here, for the fish to become established, before people could actually live here permanently, inhabit the area. Now, it doesn't mean people weren't traveling through here before that, and we have evidence that they were. I was recently looking at an artifact at the museum that we think is probably a large spear point that... It may date, be one of the earliest artifacts in this area that could be just after deglaciation. But really, we think it was, or at least I think it was probably not before 11,000 years ago in this area, maybe not before 10,000 years ago, because we're so close to the Purcell lobe of the Cordillera and glacial ice sheet. But further south in Idaho, we have older sites that go back to 11, 12,000, even earlier. So we know people were in the area, but whether they were in the immediate vicinity of Lake Pend Oreille, Sandpoint, that early is still being investigated. We do have some artifacts. The oldest radiocarbon dates we have from this area are in the range of 6,000 to 7,000 years.
With the big flooding happening, I'm again guessing no one was living here with all that ice, but would it have washed everything out prior to that also?
Well, sure.
Would it just have washed away any evidence?
The massive floods. And so anything in lower elevation would have been washed away. We have some interesting, really interesting clue. There are not very many sites, as I said, that have been actually excavated, not counting the Byway Project, but prior to the Byway Project in this vicinity. One of those, though, is one at Cabinet Gorge Dam, called Cabinet Landing. And that was mostly a historic site, but they did find prehistoric material under the historic material. But the important thing about that site is we have a volcanic ash layer from Mount Mazama. Mount Mazama, which is now Crater Lake in Oregon, erupted about 68,000 years ago. 6,800 years ago. And so we have artifacts below that ash horizon. So we know people were on the Ponderay River in the vicinity of Cabinet Gorge more than 6,800 years ago. So we're getting them 7,000 years there. And we have another radiocarbon date from the Pack River Delta in that range. But most radiocarbon dates along the Ponderay River and north end of Lake Ponderay are in the range 4,000 or less.
Fascinating. Well, we're going to take a short music break and come back and hear more about the Byway dig and maybe move from the ancient prehistory to the not so ancient.
And civilization, etc.
Here we have Peter Gabriel with Digging in the Dirt. Peter Gabriel, Digging in the Dirt. Welcome back to the morning show with hosts Phil and Julie. And this morning we have in the studio Bob Betts, a local archaeologist, talking about the history, the ancient history, and now maybe the more modern history of our area.
Yes, Bob, let's move into the Byway Project that you spent so much time on.
Well, we started working several years before the actual construction began. I was one of the first archaeologists on the project, and I started in 2006. When the Lakeside Inn was demolished, it's down there by at the end of the bike path, or the parking area as you go into City Beach, and that was one of the first things to happen because that was one of our focal areas for the archaeology. We had to move that, get that motel out of the way, and we had to remove the asphalt from the parking lot and the fill because that was a major focus, probably. 70% of our work was in that vicinity. So we did the archaeology from 2006 until about 2009. We went through 3 years and about 10 different field sessions. We could only work at low water. Many of the artifacts were below the water table at high lake level. And that was in one aspect that was difficult to deal with because as we dug down, we had to install a pump system to get the water out of the excavations. And it was somewhat messy and difficult excavation. And we had to wet screen artifacts because they just couldn't use the standard dry screening techniques. But in another respect, it was really good because that underwater context, that anaerobic context preserved a lot of the organic material, a lot of the leather and even paper and perishable things that wouldn't have lasted.
Sure. And Bob, how big was the crew working?
We had over 20 archaeologists, and we had a number of field technicians. My son was one of them that got hired on. We needed a lot of people to carry buckets up from the excavation to the wet screening operation. We had a pump and a hose system so we could put the buckets of that were removed from the excavation, the bucket of dirt into a large wet screen and wash them down with sort of like a fire hose. So it was the only way we could recover that material.
So take us through the layer cake of stories that you unfolded.
Okay. Well, we we were doing historic archaeology. Almost all the archaeologists on the project were historic archaeologists. There's a big distinction between prehistoric work and historic work, and there's some different techniques and methodology involved there. But I was one of two prehistoric archaeologists. We were trying to document aspects of early Sandpoint that were have been overlooked. There, until Nancy Rink recently, as part of this project, she was contracted to publish a book on the early history of the Humbert Mill from 1900 to 1943, when the mill dominated Sandpoint.
I have that book. It's very interesting.
Yes, A Glorious Field for Sawmills. Nancy did a wonderful job, and I think that's available at Vandeford's, last I checked. She was contracted by the Byway Project. So that was one of the products of the project. But we were trying to flesh out some of the history that was less known. And using archaeology and the artifacts we recovered, plus historical resources, we wanted to focus on some of the minority groups, the Chinese especially. A lot of our excavation involved excavation of a Chinese laundry, and which turned out to also be an opium den. We recovered a variety of opium paraphernalia from the laundry site, ceramic pipe bowls with Chinese characters on them, pipe stems, metal tins that opium was purchased in. Opium at the time was not illegal.
Well, what I have to just interject and say, as you said earlier before the interview, history does repeat itself, doesn't it? Kind of having that again today.
Yeah, we could. Yeah. Opium largely came from Spokane, and the Chinese could not buy it, I don't believe. They could use it. It wasn't illegal. But there wasn't a large Chinese population. There were probably half a dozen Chinese living here. Of course, as the railroad came through, Sandpoint began in 1882 with the arrival of the Northern Pacific Railroad. Prior to that, there was a small store, trading post here, the Weeks store, and I think 1881, that started a year before the railroad arrived. But then the railroad came in, and a lot of Chinese were involved in the railroad construction. But they moved on. They moved through pretty rapidly within a few months after they got the bridge across the lake built and then moved on towards Hope. Many more of them stayed in Hope, but a few remained in Sandpoint. And so we're trying to flesh out that story, and we found both from the artifacts and the early history, but we found gaming pieces. Quite a number of Chinese ceramics. We had at the University of Idaho, they have Asian American Cultural Center, and we had that's the repository for many of the Chinese artifacts in Idaho. And so we worked closely with them during the analysis of the material recovered. We also find quite a number of Chinese coins, not only at the at the laundry and that we excavated, but also at the elsewhere in the what we call the restricted district. So this was early Sandpoint. When Sandpoint was a pretty rough and tumble town when it got started, there were something like 27 saloons and three churches. So you can see where the focus was. As more families moved in, the women decided that they wanted to get that element moved out of town, and so Sandpoint, of course, started on the east side of Sand Creek and along the railroad tracks. But as a result of fires, there was a bad fire in 1894, and then the fact that there was just not much room to expand over there on the other side of the creek. So around 1900, businesses started moving across the creek to the west side where the town is now. And so in the early 1900s, the ladies of town decided that they wanted to get what they considered the bad elements out and concentrated back over there on the other side of the creek. where they were out of sight. So the saloons and dance hall and a couple of brothels became established over there on the other side of the creek. And that's where our main excavation focused. Now, we were targeting a period. There are artifacts throughout the stratigraphy over there, going through the 1930s, 1940s, 1950s, and on. But we were trying to target that period from 1882 until about 1917, 1920, which is when the old town site was over there and when the restricted district was over there. So we were excavating the saloons and coming up with lots of beer bottles and shot glasses and some guns and some pistols and some cartridges and all and poker chips and all the kinds of things you might expect to find at a saloon. We were excavating the dance hall, but I spent a lot of time with there were two brothels over there, and it was the red light district. And what surprised us, we would know brothel. We would find more champagne bottles in there than we found in the saloons. We found flower pots. Remains of ceramic flower pots and lots of jewelry, rings and brooches and hair pieces and combs, the things that you might expect to find there. But what it surprised us the most, I think, was that we found lots of toys from children. We found marbles and especially parts of dolls, plastic dolls. We thought, what are these doing here? In the brothels. And as it turns out, we want part of this project in combining the history and the material culture along with the historical information. We were able to target some information. We found a ring with the initials TE on it. And that led us on a search for who might have, in one of the brothels, and that led us on a search for who that ring might have belonged to. And we found a newspaper article from 1909 that talks about one of the ladies there who gave her name as Trixie Colton. And she was involved in a theft, or somebody that lost $200, a lumberjack that lost $200 and was accusing her about that. So she was interrogated by the police. Well, we thought, well, who is this Trixie Colton? And then we came up with a list of the ladies that were working there in 1910. And there's no Trixie Colton in that list, but there is a Trixie Edwards. Now, very likely, Trixie Edwards didn't give her real name when she was being interviewed by the police. Trixie Edwards was 25 years old, and she was born in France. And very likely, that ring we found with the initials TE on it was her ring. So we were trying to, part of the goal here, the focus, was trying to connect the archaeology with real stories about people who lived here. What we could glean from the historical record that would flesh out the archaeological record. And that's one of the stories. The final report for this project was published in 2013. It took 3 years to write. It involves four volumes plus some appendices. Two of those volumes deal with the history, and one involves the prehistory.
Some fascinating stories. Are the stories preserved? Have you written a book, or are they?
They are in the final report, which is called The Other Side of Sandpoint, Early History and Archaeology Beside the Tracks.
Sounds like the fun side to me.
Yeah. And so this, I don't know how many copies of this were made. The Idaho Department of Transportation funded the report and the analysis. The report distribution, I'm sure the Sandpoint Library has a copy. I expect the Bonner County Historical Society has a copy. The copies went to universities and it went to various professionals and people that worked on the project. But it wasn't, I suspect there's probably only a couple of hundred copies, so it's hard to find. But I'm sure you could find it at the Sandpoint Library.
So what about all of the artifacts? Are they on display somewhere, or did Trixie get her ring back?
I'm glad you asked. No, she didn't. we don't know where she went after Sandpoint. But the part of the funding that was for, in addition to the excavation and Nancy's book, part of the funding supported an exhibit at the Bonner County Historical Society. There's a very professional and nice exhibit on the Sandpoint Byway excavations. If you go to the museum, there is one room in the back that is dedicated to the byway archaeology with lots of the very best of the artifacts on display there, and along with other information about the project.
Fascinating project. Another really good reason to get over to the museum. Bob, we're going to wind up pretty soon because we're beginning to run short on time, but let's talk a little bit about the current state of archaeology. If there were a young person wanting to go into this field, what might they do? What might their opportunities be?
Well, both the University of Idaho and Washington State University in Pullman have archaeology programs within their anthropology departments. To get into it, you generally need to have at least a four-year degree, an undergraduate degree in anthropology. And whether you specialize in archaeology or not is may not be necessary. But there is employment. A lot of the archaeology basically breaks down to either academic research or cultural resource management. Most of the jobs are in cultural resource management. And there are the Forest Service, Bureau of Land Management, National Park Service, federal and state agencies all have archaeology positions, and they often hire temporary employees for the summer for projects. But one place to go to find out what's happening, and if you want to get experience in archaeology, and oftentimes you don't need that four-year degree, is there's a website called Shovel Bums, shovelbums.org. And I looked at it this morning. People who are advertising who need field workers, and it may not just be the United States, it may be anywhere in the world, advertise through that and other websites to get field workers.
But it might be a nice way to begin understanding whether that's the field for you, whether you'd be interested in pursuing more education in order to do more work.
Exactly.
Yeah,
and there's
it's a good
plenty
start.
Of, plenty of people that move around from project to project as temporary field hands to get experience.
Ski bum in the winter and shovel bum in the summer.
There you go.
Yeah.
Sounds like a fun bumming life. I might have to look that up. Well, Bob, I want to really thank you for joining us today. It's been an interesting conversation, and we'll have to have Nancy in and move ahead into the history of Sandpoint, but the archaeology has been very interesting to learn about. I want to thank you.
Thank you for coming in this morning, Bob. If you've missed any of the interview and you'd like to listen to it again, we'll have it up as a podcast in the next day or two. And as always, if you're away from us and want to hear the weekly Tuesday morning show, you can listen to us live streaming at krfy.org, where the podcast is as well. Taking us out, we're going to take Bob back up to Alaska with Johnny Horton. Johnny Horton, north to Alaska. Like the Klondike Gold Rush folks, he went up in the wintertime, an inauspicious time to start a project in Alaska.
That's for sure.
We're back with the morning show, and we're going to talk a little bit about upcoming events. But first, the Wednesday morning show is with host Chris Bessler and Local Decision 2016. For the rest of the Wednesdays between now and the election, Chris and Susie will be hosting local candidate races. Tomorrow, October 12th, we'll feature House Seat A, District's Jessica Chilcott and Priscilla Giddings, along with, I believe, also the Seat B, Senate seat, Ken Myers and Carl Crabtree. So tune in to hear their stand on important issues. That's right here at 8 o'clock on 88.5 KRFY.
And then Thursday, of course, is Jack Peterson and his guest, Jeff Rollo, who is from the North Idaho Mountain Sports Education Fund. So don't miss that one on Thursday morning at 8. And then next week, that'll be October 18th, join me, Phil is going to be out of town, and my guest, who will be Kenan McClintock. He's from the Nature Conservancy, and we're going to be talking about projects in northern Idaho. And again, that's next week at 8 o'clock.
And then our local decision next week on the 19th will feature District 1 House Seat B candidates Sage Dixon and Stephen Hallett. The local decision on October 26th will feature District 1 House Seat A candidates, Heather Scott and Kate McAllister. November 2nd will be District 1 Senate race, Sean Keogh and Steve Tanner. And then on the 9th, there'll be a postmortem after the Election Day wrap-up with local and print media reporters.
Lots of interesting political talk coming up. But in the meantime, let's talk about some interesting fundraisers going on. One that I think everyone might like to be included in is Team Autism. That's 27-4. It's fundraiser, bail breaker, tap, takeover, and that's at Idaho Poor Authority. That's going to be Wednesday, October 12th from 5 to 8. And it's really a great, great cause. So let's try and support Team Autism. And upcoming for our station, KRFY, is our online fundraiser. That begins October 16th and goes till the 23rd. It's an online auction. It's called Bidding for Good. And there are a number of individuals we're going to thank for their donations. We have preseason Seahawks tickets, a room at the Seattle West Hotel. There's a tropical island condo. There are sailboat excursions, fine dining, flowers, event tickets, Schweitzer condo, bottles of fine wine. And then there are a lot of little things that you should just check out that aren't too expensive and might be worth bidding on. So please check that out at biddingforgood.com, KRFY.
This is one of the ways you can help support community-supported radio for North Idaho by bidding online during the auction. It's a wonderful cause, and of course, it's something we dedicate a lot of our times to.
Yeah, it's really worthwhile. I'm going to mention one more thing. I don't have a date set for this yet, but we do have an Adopt-a-Highway crew, KRFY, too, and that's going to happen the end of October. So I'll send that out to those of you who are already members and volunteers, and if you'd like to join me, it'll be a fun morning.
Yeah, you've got to pick the trash up before it freezes over for winter.
Phil, it's fun. Yeah. Good exercise.
Coming up this week on the 15th, Saturday, Blaze and Kelly are at the Panada Songwriter Circle. I think it's their inaugural Songwriter Circle event. Is that right, Julie?
Should be.
It's an intimate evening of song and stories with Blaze and Kelly at 7:30 p.m. at the Panada Little Theater, right next to the big one. And this evening will be a memorable lineup of close and personal experiences with the singer-songwriter. You can learn more at blazeandkelly.com or at panada.org. What about some other upcoming events, Julie?
Well, we do have the Queen Bee Drag Halloween. You can kick off Halloween with a sensational Queens and Kings. Compete for cash prizes with your best costume. So you can... Oops, we're going to... I'm losing track of that. Okay, that's going to be on the 15th at 9 p.m. Doors open, and it's at the Sandpoint Eagles. That might be an interesting evening for some of you. For more info, you can call them at 208-946-0607.
It seems early for Halloween.
Yeah, a little early. I don't have my costume set yet.
No, I don't think I have a good enough costume for that particular one.
That's for sure. Let's see, a lot of our usual things. We've still got the farmer's market going for a little while, and we also have on the 22nd, the 64th annual Northside Harvest Dinner. Do you dream of the traditional homemade turkey dinner, all the time-honored side dishes? Come for that. For more information on that one, you can call 208-290-1479. I think we're running short of time, aren't we, Phil?
That about wraps it up for this morning. And again, if you've enjoyed this morning's show, you can listen to it as a podcast in the next couple days. Tune in each week on Tuesdays for our show, on Wednesdays and Thursdays for the other morning shows. You can always listen live streaming at krfy.org. And we're going to go out with a little bit of Simon and Garfunkel, My Little Town.